Good afternoon and welcome to the meeting of the Champaign County Mental Health Board. At this time, we'll have our call to order. Will you read the roll, please, Stephanie?
Pastor Burson.
Here.
Alan Danaby.
Here.
Bill Gleason. Ernie Golrude.
Here.
Dolores Hand.
Here.
Michael Cullen. Tom Moore.
Here.
Julian Rappaport.
Here.
Jeffrey Townsend.
Here.
Thank you, Stephanie. The next agenda item is citizen input. If you would like to come and make some comments, please give your name, address, and limit your talks to 5 minutes, please. Okay, if there's no citizen input, then we can skip around in the agenda and go to new business, and then we'll come back and do some other things. So at this time, we'll have Dr. Sales start his presentation on PLL.
Thank you very much.
I'm Lynn Kerr, and I'm with Hornby Zeller Associates, which is an independent research firm that actually did.
Bring everybody up to speed on the historical content and talk about all the partners that were involved. There are many partners in this. As you can see on the screen, we have a family that actually went through the program here. Thank you for coming. We had Champaign County Probation, Juvenile Detention, State Attorney's Office, Champaign County Mental Health Board, Project Access, Youth Assessment Center, and Public Defender's Office. So in order for these outcomes to be presented today, all of these agencies came together as partners to show you what we've got to show you today. Now, as we get started, I met Peter, I think maybe it was 2008, 2007, and I was going to ask Peter just to say a few words about what were the challenges
Sure. At the time when I first met Scott, we had begun trying to prepare for the federal grant that we applied for and ultimately got, but at that time we hadn't gotten it. And we had a project that was focused on, the board had decided that it wanted to place emphasis on services to kids in the juvenile justice system that also had some either mental health or emotional disturbance issues. During the course of that, as that project was unfolding, we began to look at the data that we were getting, and we had very, what I would call very bad data. We had lack of engagement of families. In fact, one of the agencies that we were working with had 0% engagement. No families took them up on what they were willing to offer. So we were very disappointed, and when I went down, I saw actually at this was a presentation for juvenile court judges and state's attorneys, national conference in St. Louis, and Dr. Sells was the keynote speaker for the whole conference and did a presentation on PLL, and I was impressed with what I heard, and we talked, and then we brought Dr. Sells up to kind of talk about what he was going to do, and after that occurred, we had some interest from the state's attorney, and actually I see Joe Gordon is here from Court Services, Director of Court Services, and we, before we made the decision to move forward with this, we essentially asked them to check with their counterparts in the other areas of the country that had PLL and, you know, and ask how it looked and how it was working. And basically they were the people that vetted the program for us. They came back and said, we like what we hear and we want to go ahead. And at that point then, this board allocated dollars to implement the program here in Champaign County and with the extended care at Prairie Center. And the front end services were at Community Elements. And
in this pilot, we are trying to serve the highest risk juveniles in the probation department. And the goal is that to keep them out of detention, to keep them out of residential treatment, and to create higher public safety. As you can see up on the screen, when we first came, there was a large number of kids going into detention a second or third time. There was very low rates of parent involvement. A lot of the times we weren't serving the highest risk kids with the high minority population, specifically African American youth. There was long lengths of stay. The average family would be in community mental health or in treatment for an average of 7 months. And they did not have outcomes. Now that is normal. In the states that we've been in, this is because a lot of times we don't always have the resources to do this kind of study. But the downside of that is mental health is one of the only industries where the FDA would never approve the drug without clinical trials, yet with treatment in mental health, many models are used without any outcomes because we just don't always have the manpower or resources to do what we want. And it takes a long time to get kids, because we're studying kids 12 months after treatment to see if they're going to recidivate, or get rearrested or re-adjudicated or go back to court. So we want to present that today. Now, just to give you a feel, some of you saw this in the news that came out a while back, but I just want to show you a quick clip from this because this was in Champaign. So you can kind of get a sense of one parent's perspective, but it also shows you a little bit about the program as we go into the outcomes. So let me just show you just a little bit of this.
PLL, Parenting with Love and Limits, is actually a lifesaver for our family.
And without that program, this mother feels her son is destined for a life behind bars.
Good evening, I'm Jennifer Roscoe.
And I'm Dave Benton. It's called Parenting with Love and Limits. The program runs through the Perry Center. Now it counsels families whose kids are dealing with mental and behavioral disorders. WCIA3's Jeff Wagner is live in Urbana tonight. And Jeff, some of those kids end up in detention.
That's right, Dave, and I'm standing right in front of the Juvenile Detention Center here in Champaign County. PLL's goal is to keep troubled youth from landing in this spot, and much of that process starts at the home with the parents.
It's brutal. It's very gut-wrenching.
it's an excruciating process that I wouldn't ever wish on anyone else.
Stacy Cole feels that way because her 17-year-old son isn't at home. He's here at the juvenile detention center. And the toughest part is she suggested it.
Our main goal was to make sure that he was safe from himself and safe so that he couldn't do harm to anyone else.
Her son was acting out in school. He also got arrested for vandalizing cars. Cole tried taking him to behavior centers, but can't afford the treatment psychiatrists suggested. Thankfully, the help of Parents with Love and Limits is free.
We work with the teens, we work with their parents, and we hold groups once a week for 6 weeks. We also conduct individual family sessions once a week for 6 weeks.
But the one-on-one counseling doesn't stop there. Therapists meet with clients in school, help them through court, and visit them while behind bars.
The therapist put a lot of blood, sweat, and tears into it, and we're working with parents who really care about their teens and want good outcomes. They want good relationships with their teens.
These professionals behind this program really gave our family hope. It gave us people to turn to.
Bryson and Cole went before the board of directors of the Prairie Center tonight. They want to talk about the success of the program and vouch for its funding in the future. Live in Urbana tonight, Jeff Wagner, WCIA 3, your local news leader.
Jeff, thanks. We're digging deeper now for you. Bryson showed a report to the board, basically looking at the program's success over the past few years. In Champaign County, the average length of time a minor spends on probation is 20 months. But for PLL grads, the average only 3 months. That's a drop of more than 80%. Well, we talked to Teresa Zeebe, supervisor of the juvenile probation program. She says judges have a positive view of PLL graduates, and that directly affects how long they're on probation.
Most of our kids, they're hard to get put into services because they don't follow through with things. So these PLL will track them down and try to find the families, work with the families, go to the homes, go to the schools, and that's what our families need.
Now about 70% of the PLL clients stick with the program. Zeebe says that success rate sets it apart from the rest.
Well, I'm Liam Bryson, PLL with Prairie Center. I've been with the program since the inception here, 2009. To my left is Aaron Grace, who's been with us for approximately 3 years. To Aaron's left, we also have Marla Elmore, who has a dual duty, being the assistant superintendent over there at the Juvenile Detention Center, as well as one of our co-facilitators at JDC, and she's been with us from the very beginning as well. And Mr. Montel Smith, who's looking pretty dapper in the pink shirt there, he's been with us for about a year and some change. We've seen a lot of things come and go in PLL from the very beginning. When I first started, engagement was a challenge because we didn't know what we were embarking on. So from, you know, very early on, we would maybe make several phone calls to families to try to engage them. But over the years, we've come to realize that, you know, that didn't work. You know, calling families at odd hours never worked. Sometimes their phones would be disconnected or we would have the wrong number. So when we would get a referral from probation or juvenile detention center, we've realized that we had to, you know, knock on doors. We've had to meet them in at court for their court dates. We've had to go the extra mile to track down these families. And so we know that we have to do 80% of the work at the onset before we even begin working with these families. A lot of families that we've encountered are very angry, the family is disjointed. There's a lot of tension in the family, and that's been over time. This is not something that just happened when they first came to PLL. You know, we're the extended care team, so we get them towards the end of, or when a crisis is taking place. And we know that, usually when people respond or want services, it's when a crisis has occurred or when there's major issues on the way. So we've seen a whole lot go on. We've seen, you know, teens raising parents, which is totally the opposite of what we're trying to do. The structure in the home is very fragmented. Sometimes there's no parent in the home, or a grandparent is taking care of the teens, or the teens are taking care of themselves and they're just kind of out there.
One of the things we partnered with was to say, using PLL as an evidence-based model, you would receive a first 5-day intensive training, and it's manualized and also the video supervision. Have you guys grown in your expertise as clinicians?
When I first started, again, I didn't know what I was getting into. I mean, you know, we're talking about, you know, the 5-day training that's like going back to school, 8 hours a day, and is very overwhelming. It's too much information, but that's another story. There are times we have biweekly meetings where supervisors would meet with us to see how we're doing, what's going on with our cases, our more intense cases. In addition to, we have to submit a lot of paperwork to our supervisor. So we're constantly being monitored in terms of meeting the fidelity of the model. There's a whole lot of work that goes into it. But I think we've grown over the years in terms of being able to meet certain marks in what we do, from engaging families to facilitating great groups, individual sessions. I mean, it just goes on and on. So,
and the elements of the program, if you look up on the screen, thank you, Leon, is that there's a person by the name of Mark Lipsey, who's one of the top researchers in juvenile justice, and he looked at 548 studies from the very beginning of research with this population. And what he found was that you want to treat high-risk youth with a high-end intervention. That this is an intense model. It's like going to Mayo Clinic and getting kind of intensive chemotherapy for this group of young men, young women. Also, the focus needs to be on treatment rather than just on probation or monitoring. It's a combination of Joe Gordon's folks working closely with us, with the state attorney, so that we're doing both and. Looking at these modalities together, skill building, mentoring. Many of you have seen Super Nanny here in the audience. This is kind of like Super Nanny on steroids, because the families really want skills instead of going back to their childhood. And their kids putting their fists through the wall, or they're swearing at them. They don't want to say, how do you feel? They want tools to fix the problem fast. And they also want this, also he pointed out that you had to have the model with high fidelity, or that people were doing the model as it was supposed to be done. So the big area that we looked at is that we saw that if we didn't change the parents in these areas, limit setting, emotional attachments, and improved communication, it didn't matter what you did with the teenager, the child would often relapse. A case in point is when in the 80s and 90s, they would send a whole lot of kids to residential for 8 months, 9 months, 10 months. And they would actually come back to their family looking healthier than their family is. But the parents remain unchanged in these areas, relapse would occur sometimes within months. So, in Champaign and other places, the thing that we wanted to look at is, could we engage the family? Our first research question was, could we get 70% of the families to voluntarily go through all of these steps in treatment over a 3-month period? And I guess I wanted to ask the families at this point, from your experience, you did group, you did family work, what has been some of the game changers from your point of view?
It's helped me talk to Ethan more than anything. That was where our problem was how I talked to him was a real problem. And he wasn't hearing me, and I wasn't hearing him. I wasn't willing to change, and he was frustrated. So Aaron and Montel were instrumental in helping us, giving him a platform to talk to us without any repercussions. And in that, it's allowed Steve and I to see things that we wouldn't have seen otherwise.
So it gave you those tools to help
absolutely
with the communication, which is one of the areas that we just talked about.
Absolutely.
It's kind of along the same lines about communication. One other thing that I thought was really important, it made us kind of look at ourselves and see what we were doing and how we were communicating. And then having Montel and Aaron there to kind of show us like how my style is so much different than Cammie's and Ethan's, you know, and how we have to kind of learn from each other and, you know, do a better job of talking with each other.
Did you like the Prius approach of like gas and electricity where you had group and coaching? Did the group help you feel like you weren't so alone and that there were other families going through it? Did that help sometimes you guys feel more hopeful or maybe?
Yeah, I think it's really helpful to have group sessions, you know, because you can learn a lot from other people as well, you know, and I feel like there's other groups that were there, other people that were there that learned from us and we learned from them, you know, and kind of made you feel like you're not alone in this, you know. There's other people having the same kind of problems, same kind of backgrounds, things like that. And I think it opened up Ethan's eyes, too, you know, to kind of
I was going to say the same thing. Ethan was, it's that his parents aren't the evil ones. You know, he's not alone, that, you know, his parents aren't awful. That there are other parents that are struggling with the same kind of things. And I think that helped them to realize that, you know, he doesn't have the worst parents in the world.
you guys did a lot of work because if you think about it, you know, I just wanted to show you a little bit terms of the types of kids that we worked with here. We just go over this and then we'll delve into the report just briefly. One thing that, is Joe Gordon here? Hey Joe. We talked, and one of the things that I remember our early conversations is you said to me, and I'm paraphrasing, Scott, we have a huge disproportionate minority contacts or just, and we also have high risk kids, and sometimes those kids fall through the cracks. And so we hope that this model will help engage the families because that's something that we see as sometimes. Did you see some of those issues as I described in terms of how PLL is trying to come in and work with those types of families?
The thing that amazed me from the very beginning was the willingness to work with very difficult families or families that were struggling with their children. I've been around a long time, and we've worked with a lot of agencies in the community, and I think they did the best they could. But the argument that I always got was, I wish we could get these kids when they're 11 or 12 or 13, and my argument was, well, now they're 15, 16, we just can't drop them. We've got to do something. And that gets back to Peter's response in working with Peter to bring in PLL. And this was the first group that I'm aware of that was evidence-based, and this was something that the Administrative Office of Illinois Courts wanted us to do, to bring in somebody who was evidence-based to work with difficult kids or families, and that it was, that we could, over a period of time, see some change. And over the years, we've seen some consistency in the facilitators, and length of time the facilitators have been with the program, excellent facilitators. And also, when we talked initially, there was some discussion about, you know, I'd like to work with these kids while they're in detention.
Right.
And you said, oh, that's great. So there was never, any time we threw something out at Scott about, you know, let's do this or let's try this, oh, that's fine. Yeah. So I did appreciate that. And
you brought your own staff to help out.
We did. Like we did initially have our own staff involved. We wanted to get the program up and running. We wanted to, you know, for them to eventually step out of it once there was some consistency with facilitators, and I think that worked out pretty well.
Marla, what's your role?
Well, besides being a supervisor at the detention center, I volunteered to be a co-facilitator for the group. So when we have a group in the detention center setting, we have them there periodically. Sometimes we have kids actually in custody who start in the group. Sometimes we have kids that start in the group and end up in custody. So they're able to continue with the group process without that being interrupted because of being detained. Sometimes they're detained and start the group and then are released and they can still continue the group in the same setting. I think what, and so I co-facilitate the groups with, and they usually rotate a little bit as to which facilitator comes in and helps out. So there's some continuity there. It also has provided opportunities for a lot of the families whose kids are kind of on the path to being detained. They've had some police contacts. Maybe they've been on probation but never been in juvenile detention to kind of, you know, we've sort of incorporated a little mini tour whenever we do group just to answer any questions and, you know, what's the detention center like and what's it, you know, what do we do there? And it also, you know, promotes this idea that just because a kid is detained doesn't mean that services stop. You know, that it's, there's that part of his legal process, but just because he or she is there doesn't mean we're not going to continue services and doesn't mean they can't continue to participate in this. I think for me the most, because my background's in counseling and education, so working in these sorts of programs, it wasn't unfamiliar to me, but what has really made an impact was the fact that this program isn't just, as Scott said, send the kid off somewhere, which says to the family that it's his or her fault. It's all about them. All the family problems are about them. Or it's not about sending the parents to counseling and saying, well, you're just bad parents. This program says this is about everybody, and it brings the family together and says this isn't just you, or this isn't just you, this is all of you. And not only is this a family problem or issue, but the solution is family-centered.
What I loved about it was that juvenile detention got together with the, you know, providers of services, and there's this collaboration among systems. And Julia, you were very instrumental in the beginning too, because this is a pilot. So what were some of the areas that you were looking to see before the study started, and some of your areas? Years I've done this, I've never had a state attorney have, in the beginning of the program while we're trying to figure everything out, have everybody meet in her office with all the files this side and figure out where which kid is most appropriate for the program. That just does not happen. Okay? So to have people like Teresa, Marla, Joe, Julia Reed, all come together and say, hey, this is going to be like a transformational catalyst to help break silos. Because one kid always said, I'll never forget, I'm an oppositional kid because I'm part of an oppositional system. The system sometimes doesn't look as healthy as we do. So the youth that we wanted to study, and I'll go through the outcomes now, is that We also were serving a lot of kids that were high risk were male, percentage were female. This was very important. The age of first offense was that, you know, we were serving younger kids who were just starting out to have problems, and that was significant.
Actually, that's not what that meant, but that number.
Okay, you're the researcher. Yeah.
When we were looking at, actually, they are younger, but this is not the slide that talks about that. When we're looking at a kid whose first offense was when he was 15 and a half, versus a kid whose first offense was when he was 14 and a half. That kid who was first arrested when he was 14 and a half is likely to be a tougher kid. And so when we were looking at, remember Dr. Sells said that the PLL was supposed to serve, it's a high-end intervention, it's an intense intervention, the version of it that we're looking at here today, and that they deal with at the Prairie Center. And those kids are high-risk kids. And one of the ways in which we see that they're high-risk kids is that they were younger the first time they offended. These are kids who started out early on the path to destruction, as opposed to the ones who started out later.
So basically, this represents, like it says on the slide, a more difficult subsection.
Yes. And here we're comparing the PLL youth to the general population, the general juvenile justice population, not the kids that we compared them to eventually in the study. We'll talk a little bit about that later.
This was really important, if you could speak to this one.
Yes?
I'm sorry, I don't really want to interrupt your presentation, but I want to understand one thing. Could you say something about how the children are selected to be in the program in the first place? There's presumably some quite a bit larger number of kids who, in a random sense, could qualify. So I just want to know, how do they get selected in?
Well, there are two parts to PLL. There's the front end, and then there's the deep end. And what we're talking about here are the deep end kids. The front end kids are, the program is shorter, it's less intense. They generally come into the program through our station adjustment program, which now is handled through the Regional Planning Commission and the Court Diversion Program at the Youth Assessment Center. So they get referred to PLL through that program generally, but they also can be referred by the schools, by counseling programs, they can self-refer, all of that. On the deep end side, they generally are referred, they generally are kids who have been charged, where a juvenile petition has been filed, and they've come through the juvenile detention center. But again, they can self-refer through the schools or through any other organization. What we used to do is we used to sit down, like Scott said, with a big pile of files and go through and say, is this kid appropriate? Is that kid appropriate? And worked out what, you know, tried to work out who went where. But we've gotten to the point where we have a better understanding of that now. So the two different sides work together very well. If there's a kid that comes in through the front end, but it's a much more complex kind of situation, they'll transfer it over to the deep end program and vice versa. But generally, their referrals are coming from probation, coming from my office, coming from the station adjustment program, from the schools, from any individuals or organizations.
Thank you. I was just trying to understand who's not referred.
Is
there some sort of pre-selection?
Well, the only
somebody
types of
decides, oh, they're appropriate.
Right.
Who's not appropriate?
Sex offenders are not appropriate. That's really the only
those families that have no parents.
Sex offenders or, right, kids who are, like, Cunningham kids who, now, if there's a kid that's in a relative foster placement and the relative foster parents are having difficulty, or they're in a semi-permanent foster placement, that would be appropriate, because it's not just, you know, mom, dad, kid, families, it's whatever a family is. But kids who are in a residential treatment facility wouldn't be appropriate for the program, and sex
one thing we wanted to see is, could we have a group of kids that had very high arrest rates? The other one was, we wanted to look at severity of offenses. And if you could maybe speak to that.
We looked at severity in two ways. This is one of them. I don't know why when I coded severity, I made zero the greatest offense, most serious offenses, and 10 the least serious offenses, but that's how I happened to code it. So the fact that PLL has a lower number here means that the PLL offenses were in general more serious, more likely to be felonies and that sort of thing. This was a combination of factors, I think. Peter addressed the issue that some providers simply weren't willing to take on the toughest cases, and violent offenders are often among the toughest cases. As a result, the PLL youth ended up being, half of them were had a violent charge against them. That that was sort of a surprise to me when I started looking at the numbers. Gee, where did all these violent offenders come from?
So let's go through each question. Go to page 2 of the report, if you wouldn't mind. And let's kind of go through this together and then answer questions as we go along. So the first research question we wanted to ask was, does PLL achieve a high graduation rate? So if you go to page 2, you'll see that 72% out of 155 families went through the program, and they had to work really hard. They had to attend 5 out of 6 groups that were 2 hours each, sometimes on Tuesday evening, Wednesday evening. They had to attend at least 6 2-hour family coaching sessions. The graduation criteria was remain at home, remain in school, stay out of trouble, and stabilize mental health issues. And the majority of these families volunteered to come. So 72% did all this hard work with on a volunteer basis. That is very significant, because as Peter Tracy said, before PLL, that rate might have been 20% or less. But this was a really encouraging outcome. This shows you that most of the kids came from probation, like Julia said, but they also could come from mental health, severely emotionally disturbed, or they could come from diversion. And we actually started to do a better job of making sure the diversion kids, those kids that just had curfew violations or truancy, they weren't involved in the system, they went more to the front end. The kids that were more serious were served in this model. And as you also see here, 74% had the highest rate of risk. If you could maybe speak to that.
Yeah, 74, one of the questions that you face when you're looking at an intervention like this, and you start saying, well, you know, the graduates did so much better than the control group. Well, did you throw out all the high-risk kids? You know, did you not graduate the really tough cases? So that, you know, of course your numbers look good. You cherry-picked your graduates. Well, no. You had a 72% graduation rate overall. Violent offenders graduated at 74%. The group was not, in general, cherry-picked. The only group, I haven't got the slide here, but it's a little bit of additional looking at it that we did not too long ago. The only group that graduated at a statistically lower rate than overall is kids with very low-level offenses. The kids who had very low-level offenses, I postulate, I don't know, but I postulate that that is because parents said, hey, I smoked pot when I was a kid and I turned out okay. They couldn't get excited about their kid having a low-level offense and therefore weren't willing to commit to it.
Those are the kids we moved to front end.
And it's tough to go through this program. But so I think that the kids who And that goes back to what Dr. Sells said in the beginning. It's a high-end intervention for high-risk kids. The kids who didn't make it through the program, I mean, yes, there were some tough kids who didn't make it through the program, too. But in general, the kids who didn't make it through, disproportionately didn't make it through the program, were the easy kids.
And the second research question we want to ask, does PLL lower mental and behavioral, increase mental and behavioral health? So we gave the parents a pretest called the Child Behavioral Checklist, and you can see here that they scored very high, that their child had high rule breaking, aggression, attention problems, conduct problems. And one of the things that we wanted to see in our research question was, in addition to seeing if they graduated at a high rate, we also wanted to see, like I said, if these behaviors went down. So after PLL was over in 3 months, we had the parents take the test again, and they said, yes, overall, my kid's rule breaking dramatically dropped. My child's aggression, by using PLL with the group model, the skills, as these parents were talking about, they got better on aggression. They're also less oppositional. So this was a significant decline from in just 3 months. And Lynn has worked with a lot of research across the country, and according to her, this was one of the biggest jumps she's ever seen.
Yeah, I mean, when Scott said significant, he didn't have enough italics in his voice. The numbers on the CBCL, first of all, the CBCL is a very widely used, widely respected, extraordinarily well-validated instrument. We're not talking about an instrument that you can really do much with. It's very, the questions on it are very factual. My kid does this. Yes, no, or sometimes. Those are your only choices. You don't get to say, you know, well, he's gone from a 7 out of 10 to a 6 out of 10. You know, that's noise. The nature of the instrument is such, its fidelity is very high from taking each time that you take it. There are all kinds of good validation studies done on it. And you talk about something being statistically significant if a particular number that you churn out is less than 0.05. That means less than a 5% chance that this came up just, you know, hey, you flip a coin enough times, sometimes you don't get 5 heads and 5 tails. It, you know, it doesn't mean anything.
This is also moving treatment in a more structured decision-making. So if I'm a therapist and I look at these scores and I say to my family, if you went to a doctor, they would look at your symptoms, do you have a sore throat, do you have a fever? Now we're going to be almost doing blood work with the families and saying, okay, we also know that you're really high on aggression. We're going to look at the end of 3 months, if the aggression drops. That will tell us that you're ready to graduate. If you're not moving down on these scales, we need to continue treatment. So this isn't done in mental health that often, where you're actually looking at outcomes to direct your practice. The other thing we wanted to look at was, did PLL change the family dynamics? When families come in with an out-of-control teenager, there's not much cohesion. There's not much nurturance. The parents will say, I've gone so long in yelling and screaming that I don't like you anymore. I still love you, but I don't like you anymore. Families will also say, I become rigid, I'm not flexible, I don't like you, I don't want to move. We know that we have to loosen these parents up and we have to bring nurturance back to the family. Otherwise, any long-term outcomes will be short-lived. So the other research question we wanted to ask is, did we change the family structure? And also, we looked at, did the youth do better on recidivism? So if you would go to page number in your handout, at the very end, go to page number.
I don't think there are numbers on there.
I can't find the numbers on these pages.
Second, the last page.
It's the page that looks like this.
I'll put it up on the screen. So would you explain this page here, because you did the research.
Oh, you're going
right here.
Next one, that page, yeah, okay.
Let's go through this. This is...
This is, really, this is the acid test, because in the end, it's nice if you did a lot of those things, but the real question is, the whole purpose of this was to reduce recidivism. And if you didn't reduce recidivism, well, I'm glad the families are happier, but you know, that's not where we were going with it. So the question here was, what percentage of the family of the youth reoffend in the top chart are re-adjudicated within 12 months after finishing treatment?
So they're done with PLL. We look 12 months later. We see, where are you?
When I first looked at this, I thought, you know, gee, PLL's a 3-month program. How much change can you affect in 3 months? Give these kids 12 months afterwards, they're going to screw up. Because it was a 3-month program. It just wasn't long enough, because that's how our mindset works. That was not the case. PLL kids they did reoffend. 12.6% of them were re-adjudicated within a year, but 21.3% of the kids who did not go through PLL were re-adjudicated in that period. That's almost twice twice the rate. Felony adjudications, similarly. As you go down the page, these are in general statistically significant results across the board. Contacts are sort of like arrests. 37% versus 51%. Felony contacts, 19 versus 28. Charge rates, lower for the PLL kids. And although in a couple of cases the numbers were not statistically significant, they were strongly in favor of PLL. The incarceration rate was less than half, well less than half, for the PLL
kids. Which means these kids did not go on to get put in prison.
Right. And I was surprised when I went through these results. I wasn't expecting them. I also was kind of impressed that Scott never saw the data. I mean, the data went from Joe and Kirk to me. Scott didn't know what this was going to show. He kind of stuck himself out there.
And in the field, unpublished articles in this, people are happy with a 5% difference.
Yeah.
That's what I saw was really exciting to me, is when I read the literature on this, people are jumping up and down with a 5% difference. We had almost double.
Yeah. So. Yeah. It was impressive. It was impressive because it's important. It's actual kids who are succeeding, and that's impressive. But it was also impressive because of the magnitude of the change. The magnitude of the differences was surprising.
Joe had a point.
Yeah, I have one comment concerning the data, Lynn. I think that's important. Is we were very fortunate that Kirk was able to pull all this data out of this system, our integrated justice system, and he went way back. So we had a really good sample to compare with.
Yes.
And then we had our PLL group. And initially I was involved in going through all these records, and it was very time consuming. But when Kirk got involved and passed it on to you, and I think you even commented that the data that was passed on was very, very good.
Yes, it was. It was good in so many ways, and it gets back to the notion of why this isn't done very often.
Right.
And goes back to that very first slide that Scott put up about the partners. The cooperation, in order to present the results that we presented here today, we needed the folks on the ground to be doing all those CBCLs and FACES and stuff, which is time consuming and I'm sure not fun.
And, and put it in perspective, how long have you been with the department for?
36 years.
This is the first study, right?
That is correct.
Yeah.
36 years, this is the first study that ever looked at how out of a treatment due versus treatment as usual.
Yeah. And Joe's willingness to provide data, you know, I didn't work with everybody individually, but in the course of this, the work that was done by a lot of people are what are, what's being, I mean, yeah, I'm the one who crunched the numbers, but it took a village to make this happen.
And this data is so good, it's going to be published in a national journal. And when it comes out, each of you will get a copy. And if you look at the last research question on the last page, you'll see that our last question was, were PLL lengths of service shorter than standard mental health? What we wanted to see is, could we get better outcomes in a shorter time? This has cost containment implications, where you don't have to spend as much taxpayer money on kids in mental health. You also know intuitively that the longer the kid stays in mental health, the higher risk that they can get therapized or institutionalized. Case in point, I work with kids over the years where they know the diagnosis better than the clinicians do. And they're so attached to therapy that there's learned helplessness. And so we have this theory, and the research backs up, less is more. That if you can do an intensive intervention within 3 months, the family gets better. So what our last research question was, can we get better results in a shorter time? And Peter, from a board perspective, that has implications, correct? For you guys, in terms of that, if you're doing it less time and getting better outcomes, what are the implications from your perspective?
Well, I just want to see better outcomes.
Yeah, okay.
No, I mean, obviously, I think that we serve, you know, we can serve more kids, but again, I'm more interested in outcomes. So.
And families get fatigued when they're in therapy too long. And so the other thing that's really cool is that the PLL team have had, across the country, their outcomes are so strong that we had an award ceremony recently where each of them got an award for excellence because they, they shot it out of the park with outcome effectiveness. They shot it out of the park with their videotapes that they submit for us to review. They're at an advanced level at this point. Leon, you've been with the program how many years?
A long time.
Okay, a long time.
4 years.
Yeah.
4 years.
And change.
This just doesn't happen that often.
I also have to, I would be remiss if I didn't include Jennifer Ellis, who's not here, who's part of our, who's one of the therapists who made some of these numbers possible, and also Connie Kaiser, who's over JDC, who assisted us in numerous ways, from, you know, holding this, having the space available for us, to, you know, making referrals to us, to helping us with whatever we needed while at JDC. So
it was a group effort.
Major group effort.
So future advancements from this point forward is we've come up with a dashboard like you have on your car when you see that the gas light comes on. It's an indication to go to the gas station. If your battery light comes on, you will be seeing that this is where we look at the results in real time, and we're actually going to be giving the families these reports as they come in, so that the therapist and the family can continue to look at how well they're doing. So I just wanted to ask if there's any, you know, questions or comments about the outcomes. And I want to thank you as a family for coming tonight and sharing some of your story. But I just wanted to kind of ask if there were any questions or comments. Stephanie, from your point of view, what was most helpful about tonight in terms of what you saw? Sorry to put you on the spot, but
thanks.
But what were some of the things that stood out for you?
He does that after every meeting.
yeah, I'd like to get feedback.
I think it's always helpful to have a family here, someone who's been through the process, and, you know, say what it was like for them.
Thank you.
What about you, sir?
Probation officers were out in the community.
Right.
It was a whole different world. It was a lot different. You know, you didn't have the numbers. You didn't have the numbers. do if you can keep the judges and the legislatures out of your business.
What was your takeaway, sir?
My takeaway?
Yeah.
Well, I'm still trying to process it.
Okay.
So I'm wondering, what I'm actually wondering about, I think you have obviously got a widespread, strong community support for what you're doing. And I guess what I'm trying to get a handle on are those kids who are not in it. Mm-hmm. Like those 44 dropouts. Is there something different about that? What do we learn from that, since my interest would be in what other kinds of programs can we develop, what other sorts of ways can we bolster this so it's a system, not just for some kids who are selected as they're likely to do well in this. So I'd like to know more about the ones who are not put in it and the ones who are not doing well once they get in.
Well, we don't just pick the ones that we think are going to do well.
Well, I wasn't suggesting that.
I just don't
understand something about
the
other kids.
We offer it to everyone.
We might want to develop other programs.
Right, yeah. Everybody is allowed to do it, but you're right. Looking at those 44 kids, why did they drop out? You know, and that's some of the things that we're actually looking at now and will be written up in the study, because we want to know not only the attrition rates, but the graduation rates, because we can learn from that. I think we can learn more from the failures, or maybe put it qualitatively, why did they not complete the program? Not necessarily a failure, but there's a reason.
So you have some ideas about that, Matt?
One of the things that we've noticed in, part of it has to do with what data do you collect. The data that has been collected on the non-completers is not easily analyzable. But what I can see in terms of themes is that in general, it is a parent's issue. It is the, you know, mom won't come. that seems to be as much as anything the answer that is recorded as why this family dropped out. One of the things that I've talked to Scott about is you don't get a post test, you don't get a final CBCL or FACES on the kids who drop out, because you don't know that this was their last session. They just stopped coming. And so I think it would be worthwhile to look at the pretests of the kids who graduate versus the ones who drop out and see if it's possible to identify from the pretest what are some differences. Are there characteristics of those kids that are not being met? Do those kids need a different program? Does PLL need to be modified, need an additional component to handle that? I don't know the answer because I haven't had a chance to do the research, but I think that that's an important question to be asked. I mean, I think you're onto something there.
I think we can speak to that a little,
right,
being therapist, in that, like Julia said, every kid is outside of those two, sex offender and
no parents,
are afforded the option to participate in PLL. We contact them, and there is a lengthy list of reasons why they might not participate. So just to reiterate, every family is afforded this program.
What are some themes you see as to why over the year?
So some reasons that they don't want to participate is strongly related to the parents again. It's the kid not telling us they don't want to participate. It's the parent.
I mean, we catch them. There are times when we're catching them very late. So there are parents who are saying, you know, yeah, we've done one or two groups and this is not going to work because we need some answers last week, last month. And so this is not fast enough. So even though this course, this program is 3 months long, it's still not fast enough. So that's one issue. The other issue is we have parents who are saying, you know, while we're working, and we can't, our schedules won't allow us to come to every single group. And so if you miss more than one group, then now we have to start from scratch again, and some parents don't want to do that. Some kids are going on to DOJJ or Department of Juvenile Justice, and so once again, we're at a disadvantage. I mean, there's a myriad of reasons why parents and teens opt not to come to the program.
I can actually attest to some of that.
Montel called me. I'd never heard of the group. I knew nothing about it. I don't know who recommended me for it. I was embarrassed by what had happened with my child. We kind of tucked inward on him. We pulled back. We were very reserved. We were very scared. And I'd never heard of it. And here this person's calling me saying, we want you to come to our group. And I'm thinking, is this for real? I mean, are you really going to help me? You want me to come in? I didn't do anything wrong. Mm. Why am I having to be here? He's the one that did it wrong. And after the first day of talking with Aaron, I thought, wow, I really was doing a lot of things wrong. But it felt like, why are we being punished for what Ethan did? And that was, I really gave Montel the riot act. How'd you get my phone number? And who are you? And I don't know, I'm going to have to talk to his dad. And I don't know about this. And then he was like, I'll be willing to come to you. I'll give you any information you want. And I thought, I called, I believe it was Julia's office, and they recommended me to, Teresa Zeeby, I believe. And she was the one that said, yes, I did recommend you. And it was like, okay, so this is real. But there are some parents, if it were me, I was thinking, no, this is crazy.
They said it very nicely.
I did. They said,
we get the other extreme of, getting yelled at, cursed at, the whole other extreme. Miss Cammy was very nice and probably talked to Montel, what's going on. But.
Scared.
Yeah, but some of the other responses are, heck no, and this is Johnny's fault, and click. So
we do a form of a motivational interview, but to answer your question, it's a great one. That is what I'm going to be doing in phase two, is really delving into the kids that dropped out. Why? What can we do differently? Is it the program? Is it the combination? And present to the board a list of themes of what we've discovered of why the families drop out and what we're going to do to increase the odds to lower that rate more. I would like an 80% or 90%. I don't think I'll ever get 100. That's not realistic. But can we just increase the odds even 10%, 20%? Because we learned from the families that dropped out, and a lot of research doesn't even look at those families. They only report successes, not failures.
One of the most unique things about this program that I appreciate very much, so what you heard is that Montel called them. It wasn't that somebody gave them a piece of paper and said, you need to call these people, because what would you have done if we had done that? You wouldn't have called.
I was out of my element with this. Ethan had never been in trouble before, so I was really a duck out of water, and we weren't talking about little trouble. We went from absolute no trouble to a ton of trouble, and I didn't know who to talk to. I didn't know where to go. If you would have given me a piece of paper, I was so overwhelmed and so upset, I wouldn't have went through all of that.
But there's an art to get you to see that whole family, because many parents come in and say, just fix my kid, and that took courage, and that's where I think they increased the odds. What they say, how they say it, to say, we're not blaming them. What are we can't change the past. What are we going to do together to help go forward? I think even in a short time, that helps.
Well, she gave me the tools to just say that, I wasn't wrong for being upset with Ethan. I wasn't wrong for, yelling or whatever. I wasn't wrong for it, but it wasn't working.
Yeah.
And so she never blamed me.
Right. Any other questions or comments from this side of the room?
I'm interested in if you adapted this program for other communities. This is essentially
Yeah, I mean, even, that's a great question. Even tomorrow, I'm going up to St. Clair County.
Down.
I've heard about
down.
What's happening.
Down.
What?
Down.
Down to St. Clair County. I'm from Chicago, so I should know this. But they've heard about what's happening, and they see it as a whole system, so you kind of customize it. Ironically, they have the same challenges, high detention rates, low parent engagement rates. But in some communities, like Alaska, for example, we have to adapt it because you can only get to families by plane. So we've done more of a video conferencing types of things. So what we do is we go into a community, do a work group with them, get all the stakeholders together in one room, the judges, the prosecutors, the families, and we say, here's a template, but you can customize it. And then we come alongside and work with, because Champaign wanted us to work in the detention center. Because there's like, the kids are maybe only there 14, 20 days, but we're doing nothing with them, with the family, so we could integrate them. So that was an example of saying, can you adapt the model to fit what we need? Now, we won't sacrifice program integrity. We won't say, oh, we're gonna just, you know, water this down so much that you can't even tell what it is anymore. But that's a great question, where that's why we only have 12 new sites a year, and we won't go big, because we want to be a small giant and partner with the community and go that extra mile to say, we want to just change the operating system and not just keep stacking services. Because that's what happens in our field. You got another program, another program, another program. And so that's something that I've really committed to as a model developer, to partner with the community. And that's what you're seeing here, is these outcomes over 4 years came from a lot of work with all of us together. So thank you for that question.
Yeah, it seems like it's your point of entry, usually the juvenile justice system as opposed to agencies.
It depends. Like in Idaho, the point of entry is community mental health. There are no kids in certain areas of the state going through juvenile justice, but they're having emotional and behavior problems. Mm-hmm. So our point of entry is based on what the pain level is.
Okay.
And so for some states, the pain level is in foster care. For some states, it's a severely emotionally disturbed kids. And in some places like here, the point of entry was juvenile justice.
Okay.
Yeah. Yes, sir.
I'm thrilled to see the level of recidivism and how. But I tell you, I couldn't follow the program because I was so stuck on the disproportionate number of African-American kids. Either this town has grown substantially from the time that I started it, or something terrible has happened to African America. Why do we have so many African-American kids getting referred to this system? Surely our kids aren't that disruptive in the world. It's impossible.
Yeah.
There's something else that's going on.
There's some books I can recommend that give some theories, and this isn't going to make you feel any better. Probably make you feel worse. But we see this across the country.
Oh, I know that.
Yeah, and it's just. It's
not only do you see it across the country, this isn't brand new to America.
Speak to that. that, all I can say is that one of the things that we try to do is bring old school parenting into the mix. Because in the old days, families knew their neighbors. And in the old days, the whole community rallied together to help solve the problem. What PLL tries to do through the group model and even the family therapy model is to bring in friends, neighbors, anyone that's part of the community, and it's more old school parenting. I think that's where we lost it, because people don't even know their neighbors anymore. There's so much isolation today. You see it, I'm sure. And that's really been tough on parents, because they feel so isolated. And they're shamed there. They don't want to go up to their neighbor and say, I've got an out of control kid, even within their churches. In the church bulletin, it's okay to see, pray for me, I have cancer, pray for me, I have this, but you don't see, pray for me, I've got an out of control teenager. So there's just a disconnect sometimes with the community, and we're trying to go back to basics with some of these ideas. So any other questions or comments?
I think we have time for maybe one more question.
Yeah. I'm thrilled with the outcomes that you've reported. This is really exciting. In my head are a lot of voices saying, nothing's happening. This won't work. Over these 4 years, I mean, a lot of oppositional people have been expressing their opposition. So it seems to me we're going to need to find creative ways to disseminate the information about what we've learned and what is really happening. And I'm sure we can do that.
That's great. Change is always tough. And when Joe Gordon said, I've been working 35 years, this is the first study, you've heard the term go through the glass ceiling. When you go through the glass ceiling and you're one of the first, you always get cut. The other people behind you are like, thank you for going through the glass ceiling first. So that's normal. Just like when you work with family and you're the first, you get cut on the way out. But it's been very supportive overall, but we want to disseminate the information as much as we can. So thank you for that.
Well, we did have the news because that was Scott this afternoon. So.
And when it's published in the journal, you get a copy. But I want to say thank you for your belief in me. I remember coming here 4 or 5 years ago. Some of you remember me, some of you don't. But I said I'd be back in 4 years, and I kept my promise, but I couldn't have kept my promise without the support of you all. So thank you. There's more work to be done, but this is the first step.
You're going to stay with us, aren't
you? Oh, yeah, I'm staying with you.
We should get started.
Okay, let's come back to order so we can finish our meeting. Welcome back, board. We're starting with the approval of our minutes from October. I need a motion.
Deb motion.
Mike second. Okay. So now we need Stephanie to call the roll. Or Lynn, are you calling the roll?
No.
Just approval? All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? So they are approved. Thank you. And then we're skipping down to, we're just going to do one staff report. Tracy brought some interesting information he wanted to share, so we'll let him talk about that for a little bit.
Okay, real quick, two things I passed out to you just a moment ago. One is our evaluation site review that we went through last July. So I've shared with you the draft preliminary report. You'll see that there are a number of strengths with the Access Project and our community and the implementation of it. And you'll see some of the areas of challenge and growth. And so you have a few weeks to look at that. And if you have any, you know, questions, please don't hesitate to ask, and I'll be glad to get the information for you. So I wanted you to have a copy of that. We'll be disseminating the report community-wide probably after the first of the year. But it just gives a good idea of how and where the project is at. The second thing I wanted to do is a number of the staff and myself had a chance to go to the National Federation of Families Conference this past week, and a number of significant things happened. Now, the Federation of Families is the national parent and family-run organization, and so this aligns perfectly with SAMHSA and its interest in family and youth engagement and involvement. Chandra Somerville, our cultural competency person, serves on the national board for the Federation of Families. So that's happened in the last year. We're really pleased with that appointment for her. And this year we presented at a couple different sessions. So we talked about some of the family work that we were doing. And then we took two youth out with us. Retisha Carter is our youth engagement specialist. Retisha, if you want to come, just stand so they get a chance to see who you are. We were pleasantly surprised to find out at the luncheon on Saturday, come up and, okay. So.
She has to give a speech.
She has to give a speech now, right? So we were pleasantly surprised at Saturday's luncheon in front of probably about 1,500 folks that they announced the National Youth Engagement Specialist of the Year, and the person who's done an outstanding job of getting youth with mental health issues involved in system of care development. And Retisha is the national winner, so we're just. So she was nominated by the Youth Move organization, which is the youth engagement part of the system of care work. And so this was a national recognition and recommendation. And so just want to say congratulations and extremely proud of her.
That's one of those things that would be nice to get in the newspaper.
Yeah, Peter and I were talking about how can we.
Congratulations, Retisha.
Let our community know about this.
What would you like to say? A few words.
It was surprising. Not saying that, not trying to minimize the work that I have done, but they actually had one of my youth that I took up there create a speech, and so she's the one that gave it to me. And this particular youth, I have a real strong connection, and she looked at me as a mentor, and I look at her as a mentee. So proud moment. And my girls and I also presented a workshop that had a very good turnout. Like, you know, they're becoming really good youth leaders, so I'm excited.
Yeah, well, we did not, Dr. Sales' organization was there presenting at the same time that Ritesh and the youth were. But, you know, a really interesting point, I'll be real quick because I know we're trying to get out of here, but one of the youth that presented, part of presenting and talking about this is what we call telling your story. And we saw the data on Black youth as part of the PLL presentation. But when she was telling her story, she talked about she has depression. And she lost a brother who died several years ago. And it was just really an important part of the understanding of our work that she now is able to talk about her depression from a death and see that as okay. And that really is an important part of the steps that are happening. And so I just wanted to make sure we pointed that out. And again, just say thanks.
Add to that, she was never formally diagnosed, so she really leaned on natural support and didn't realize that what she was going through was depression until she had access.
Yeah. Thank you. Okay, we have to pay our bills this month, right, Nancy?
Yep.
So I need a motion. Need a second. It's been moved and second that we accept the financial report. You have to accept it. So we need a.
It's already been spent. Why approve it?
Well, everybody in favor? Opposed?
What is the $67 cheesecake?
It was very tasty.
I so thank you for approving that cheesecake.
$67.12 or something.
Julie?
Page 15.
Excuse me? If you have something to share, you can share it right now. That's exciting. I love PBIS. I'm glad that some of the schools are keeping it going. Okay, any other agencies? Okay, then we can move on to new business. Well, we did A, B is just a packet. Some information in your packet. And then you have some information about the emergency shelter for families in the packet, and you have the glossary of terms.
Can I make a comment?
Yes.
Did Stephanie do this glossary?
Stephanie, did you do the glossary?
It was a group effort.
This is great. I know we talked about it at last meeting and just want to recognize that it turned out wonderful. So thank you.
Thank you, Stephanie. And everybody else. Okay, now old business. We have our 3-year plan with the 1-year objectives in it, and it's just great work.
Second.
So it's been moved and approved, and now we have to have a roll call. Yeah. So would you? We don't? Okay. Oh, well, good. Okay, everybody in agreement, say yes.
Yes.
Any no's? Okay. Okay, for the program year 2015 allocation criteria, we just have to, I need a motion to approve it.
So moved.
Second. Second. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Okay. I think that's all the approvals that we have. And you can look at everything else. Do we have any board announcements before? Yes. Well, thank you. Okay, on the board announcements.
I have one.
Okay.
Unless we meet in December, this is my last meeting. I'll have finished up my third term, and as I was telling Tom here, I could imagine, because if I were to stay on another term, I'd be almost 90. And I could just imagine my caretaker saying, Ernie, time to change your nappy. You're sneaking up the place. So, okay. Well, it's been a real ride. I've appreciated it. It's a great board. It's been a great experience. But it's time for me to, I think 12 years is 12 years, and it's time to get somebody else to, with maybe a fresher or different perspective. We have a lot of changes that are forthcoming, and I think somebody who is more attuned to what is to come than what is has been and what its influence on us. But anyway, it's been a great ride, a great board, and I hope to still do some advocacy things for the cause, but not as a board member. So.
Just a quick comment. I want everybody to know that we are going to we are planning to have a reception for Dr. Gullerud. So we really want to honor you for the contributions you've made to our community. But I do want to make one correction. You are not officially off the board until the county board appoints your replacement, which means if, you know, Astrid, if you guys don't replace him, he has to stay on until the replacement comes. So.
I know.
I can take a picture, but I don't do those things. Many years ago, this shows you the influence of the old Clark Park neighborhood on Champaign County.
Yes.
Ernie lived a short block and a half this way, and Tom lived a long block that way, and I was in the middle.
Wow, that must have been quite a neighborhood.
Nice to know.
Ernie, it's been a real pleasure and an honor to kind of sit on this board with you. And if you think that it's time for you to step down, that's fine. But as I was saying to you earlier, self-report data is not very reliable. But if you want to do it, it's fine. But it has nothing to do with the need for newer and fresher ideas, because you have always been very progressive and strong in your advocacy for the mental health issues that we face in this county, and we're going to be hard pressed to find someone who can bring newer and fresher ideas than what you've already presented. So good luck in your second retirement, and I hope you don't find anyone to replace him.
You haven't found anybody yet, have you? Okay, they're not looking. Before we go on.
There's another redeeming fact. The food is always good, you know.
That's for sure.
I'll probably show up and sneak a box and run down the corridor.
So. You would be welcome, and thank you for your service, Ernie.
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay. I heard that there's a panel tomorrow night, and Peter's on the panel. Is that true, Peter?
Not that I know of. It was last night. It was last night.
Yeah.
Well, we missed it, right?
Yeah.
We had an interesting meeting last night.
Yeah.
It was at the League of Women Voters, and Ernie and, let's see, who else was? Jan Anderson. Was there.
Yeah.
And we did a presentation, Sheila Ferguson and Bruce Barnard and I talked about the issues related to the jail and mental health services. We were supposed to have Alan Jones as part of that panel, but because of the Gifford thing, all of the sheriff's guys were pulled off. So, but we did have a good, and that will be on Public Access TV if you weren't there last night, so feel free to watch.
I think it's another...
Congratulations, Peter.
Yeah. Like what you were saying, where was the media for that event? Because that was, you know, a League of Women Voters sponsor a lot of these kinds of things. I belong to that organization, and I really have great admiration for a group that can have respond to social justice issues in a non-political way. By that I mean they are not, they are by organizing principle, not a connected officially with any political party. They have to be non-partisan, and to they do a great many good things, and it's if you ever want another organization to belong to, I strongly recommend it. They do accept men, needless to say, and go to it.
Okay. Anything else from the board? If not, we're officially adjourned. Thank you. So we're going to have Ernie's reception and...